Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Fly the friendly skies of United. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, new episode posted. And of course, I have what they call a landing page. This is episode 51, but if you want to listen to the past 50 episodes, if you want to binge on an Elton Jim, just go to my landing page. That's what they call it, I guess, right, Kevin? A landing page?
Something like that, yeah.
It's a landing page, which means that you land on my page and you find all my past podcasts from almost a year now. So you go to WGNplus.com, and then look, there's a prompt that says entertainment, and then hit that prompt. And then when you get into that next page, you will see a list of shows, and just look for Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and there they are. So hopefully, if you listen to like episode 8, and then listen to like episode 47, and let's see if we've gotten any better at this over the last 9 months. Hopefully, the quality is still there, and yet we're getting better as we go, as we sort of settle in here. Of course, as I've joked with Kevin Richter, my producer here, he also produces for Bill and Wendy. If the shows at times are, you say, well, a little up and down. For whatever reason, I have gone through, 8, 9, 40 producers?
Yeah.
So I've had to, just when I'm hitting a nice little groove, then I'm working with somebody else. I must be a taskmaster or just a beast or a prima donna. I don't know. But I have been through at least 6 producers in now coming on a year.
I wonder if that's a record.
I don't know. And the good part is, it's been fun in that I've got to work with a lot of people here who I used to work with in the past and who I've known. And Kevin actually was a producer of ours, 10 years ago?
2010, yeah.
Well, 7 years ago.
Yeah, but yeah.
In a past life. So yeah. I remember when Kevin was a mere 20-something, and now you're a 30-something.
Yeah, I'm going gray.
Yeah. Do you have gray hair?
I have got like 4.
Yeah, well, my godson's your age, Patrick, and if he grows a beard on and off, and I noticed that he's got a few little grays. Sadly, the radio audience here, podcast audience can't see me. My goatee is completely white now. Wow. I mean, but if you notice, Kevin, they can't see it, but my goatee is a little darker than usual. I left the Just for Men on a little longer, and I went, wah! It shouldn't be this black. I mean, I need to. Now I'm looking like, I'm trying to look like I'm like 20 or something. It's like, whoa, there's got to be some gray in there. So I got to remember not to just leave it on too long. But yeah, wow. I mean, I am shocked at when you talk about gray hair, and I've got them at the temples too. And so I dye that. I don't know when to give into that yet. I don't know if ever. I think there comes a point, maybe when I'm 75, I'll go, okay, I can go gray. But until then, I don't know about that. Although you got to be careful, because like Paul McCartney, Paul McCartney's been gray for, I would say, he was definitely salt and pepperish in the 80s. Okay, so he's clearly gray, like completely white. And there's some times when Paul has that orange brown, then that doesn't look good.
No,
so you got to make sure that you do it. That's why I was blonde for about 2 years, and I didn't mind that. I went back to my natural color because I was doing a play, and the director, when I went to the audition, first thing she said to me, because I had a 8x10, my headshot, if you will. My headshot had my regular brown hair. And so she saw the headshot. Then I walk up down to the stage for the audition, and I have this blonde hair. And she goes, first thing she said, didn't even see me. I didn't even say anything yet. She goes, I got on the stage, and she goes, are you willing to dye your hair back to its original color? I'm like, whoa. I said, is that personal or professional? Does a character need blonde, or you just don't like me as a blonde? It's like, she didn't answer either. So I don't know. But so I went back to my original color. But what was nice about the blonde was that as it grew out, you couldn't tell the grays in my temple as much because it was blonde hair. So I didn't have to worry as much. But now that I'm back to the brown, yeah, I got to be Just for Menning. You know, pretty much. I should get stock in Just for Men. But anyway, so we will have Emily Armonetti later on in the podcast to do a little pop culture club. Interesting little topic today. I'm going to have fun with this one. I just got my new Rolling Stone magazine. I have a lifetime subscription to Rolling Stone about 15 years ago. I've been subscribing to Rolling Stone since I was probably 18 years old, and buying it long before then. And I finally figured, when I finally got a job in high school, I decided to subscribe. I could afford it. So about 15 years ago, when the magazine industry was really in a tough spot, not doing well, although it still is, but they were, all of a sudden people stopped buying magazines, everybody's going online, I got this offer from Rolling Stone for a lifetime subscription for $30. Now, that's crazy because usually, I mean, and Rolling Stone comes out bi-monthly, so there's two a month. So, I mean, you know, $30, I mean, I don't even know what they don't have the price on this one because it's a subscription. But I'm sure that this magazine probably costs $8 or $9 at the newsstand. So $30 for a lifetime subscription, but at that time, I'm sure they just wanted to have a list of subscribers that they could show their advertisers, say, look, you know, we've still got, you know, 1.5 million subscribers. So they were looking for people that, like me, who had been subscribers for a long time and say, hey, let's just grab these guys because we know that they like the magazine. At least we will have our names to keep some ad revenue coming in. Here's the depressing part. You know, when you look at your label on a magazine, it will usually have your subscription date as to when the subscription ends on there, you know, say June 20 or, oh, you know, 18 or something. Well, this one does too. Now, here's what I said. I've got a lifetime subscription, right? How do they know when my lifetime subscription is up? But apparently, Rolling Stone magazine, I don't know how long I'm going to live, but Rolling Stone magazine does. I don't know how they know. I don't know if they've got my blood tests, if they talked to my doctor, if they saw my stress tests. But according to Rolling Stone magazine, this is actually not bad. I'll take this. My lifetime subscription expires in September of 2053, which will leave me at 89 years old.
It's not too bad.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
No.
But my goal, I want to live to at least 2054 because I want to call Rolling Stone in 2053 for my assisted living room with my Depends diapers on and say, hey, where's my Rolling Stone? You said I was going to live to 2053. Well, I'm still alive, and I want my... Now, of course, I'll be screaming, and then when I hang up, I'll probably have a heart attack and die and not get my 2050 or my 2054 edition. But it's really scary. I look at that every time the magazine comes in. September 2053. I mean, it's sort of like staring you in the face. The end of my life is staring me in the face.
To make you feel better, I ran some numbers here.
Oh, yeah?
$9.95 per magazine.
$9.95.
You're getting them twice a month.
Right.
So that's 24 a year. That's like $200-some.
Right.
And then you add that, or you multiply that by 30-some years. You're saving $10,000.
Oh, my God. Yeah, isn't that crazy?
It is crazy.
How much?
Like, I'm looking. I just did 30 times
right.
30 just for
10?
A rough number.
I'm 10 grand?
This one's at 8,358, which you,
wow.
you will have beat.
I'm saving that if I get to 2053.
Yes.
So now I'm really going to make it. Oh, my gosh. I got to get that cholesterol down. But, yeah, so anyway, I get my Rolling Stone, and a real cool story, the 50 greatest concerts of the last 50 years. That's the new feature story on the issue with Harry Styles from, is it One Direction? Is that where he was from?
I think so,
yeah. That's how hip I am. I don't even know who Harry Styles is. But, so I thought it would be fun with Emily, who I understand just yesterday went to see Tom Petty in concert. We will talk about the list here in Rolling Stone and also then rattle off some of our favorite concerts in our life that we've seen. And I've just scribbled down a few right off the top of my head, and I got about 15. So I could actually come, I could easily come up with 50. I have to do this, I always keep threatening this. I'm going to do that in the next couple of weeks. I have pretty much every concert ticket I've ever gone to. I always save them. Now, I've been to 168 Elton concerts. I have all those. And I easily, I know, I've got it's a giant shoebox. It's not even a regular size shoebox. It's a Doc Martens shoebox, so the shoes are oversized, so the box is bigger. And I've got a shoebox filled with all my ticket stubs from the last. My first concert was 1976, so I've got like 40-some years worth of ticket stubs in there. So I should count to see how many concerts. I would have to say I've been over 500 or 600 concerts, I would think, easily. But so I should do that. And I'm really not doing much during the day. I really have no excuse not to do this. That'll kill 3 hours, right? But once a week, I come in here and do this, and we have some fun. So I thought we would talk about that with Emily in the Pop Culture Club segment. A little later, but right now, I wanted to talk about this American Airlines situation because I was recently on a plane just this past weekend, went to Boston area to visit some friends, and actually it was pretty cool. I was the only person from the Chicago area to fly to Boston the weekend that the Cubs were going to be playing at Fenway. I think I was the only Chicago Cub fan in the city flying to Boston who didn't go to the game. I made plans several months before. I wasn't looking at the schedule. And the Cubs don't play American League teams every day. So how do I even know when they're playing the Red Sox or if they're playing the Red Sox? But lo and behold, that weekend when I was in the Boston area, they were there. So theoretically, I could have gone. But, you know, my friends that we were visiting, not really big sports fans. Plus, it was an hour or some outside of Boston. So, but I felt very insecure and very left out because the plane was filled with Cub fans. I went on a Thursday. The games were Friday through Sunday. And I went on Thursday, and as people are walking on the plane or standing at the gate, everybody's got their Cub hats on, their sweatshirts, their jerseys. And not only was it scary, rabid Cub fans on the plane, this was very cool. I'm looking around, and hello, Cubs owner Tom Ricketts. Oh, hello, Cubs president and chief operations, whatever he is, Theo Epstein, on my plane. Yes, they were in first class. And no one was really going up to them. They kind of left them alone. But here's the cool part. So on American now, to make the boarding process easier, which Southwest Airlines still has the greatest boarding process. I don't know how it works, where they just give you a number and I can't believe that people stand in line and are actually orderly. But if you've ever gone on a Southwest Airlines flight, you know how efficiently this boarding process is because there are no assigned seats. There's no first class. They just give you a boarding number and you get in line and there's these little posted things there where you stand and where your line is, and people actually follow the rules. In fact, you know, they have like 37 through 38 or, you know, 37 through 39 in one little spot. And some people will say, I have 38. Am I behind you? I mean, wow. You just think, well, I'm 38, you're 37, who cares? You get on, you know, one person before me. But people actually ask you, well, you know, then I'll get behind you. It's like, don't worry about it. So I don't even know how this works because I'm you know human nature. But wow, very impressive. On American, you know, there's all these levels, and I should talk because I am gold status, so I get to board a little earlier, but not much, right? Just before the normal people. That's normal people. Oh, that didn't sound too cocky, huh? all you dregs of society who are in group two or group three. I'm gold. Thank you very much. But I'm right before all you guys. In fact, it was so great. The old way, they would ask for, you know, they would start with, you know, first class, executive platinum, executive sapphire platinum. They went through 17 of these. And so everybody's always huddling and, you know, by the thing, and they're waiting, and they're dashing in, and there's people coming in. There's no semblance of order at all. And so now what they've done is they've done away with all those first designations, and they've put, for instance, you know, their executive platinum now is group one. They've just grouped them with numbers. So now if you're in group one, group two, group three, group four, it does seem to be a little better than it was. There's still the huddling, and there's still people trying to get in before you. But now it says group one specifically, so the person taking the ticket knows that we are boarding group one, and if you come in with a group four, they say, sorry, you can't come in. But before, so now I'm in group four. I always used to be in group one priority. Still have priority, but now I'm in group four. But what was so great was when I would travel with my wife, she doesn't have any kind of status, you know, in more ways than one. No, I'm just joking. I've been married for 27 years. Give me a break. And, was it 27? It will be this year. So, I would always joke because I would be in group one and then her ticket would say like group four or group five. Now, because I had priority seating, she could board with me, even though she had a lower group. But just between us, I would sit there and always, when we'd get our tickets from the kiosk or whatever, I would say, you know, I say, oh, I'm group one. What group are you in? She's like four. And I was like four. I'm like, oof. I've heard about people from group four. I wouldn't want to sit with any of them, but I've seen some of them. I don't know if they bathe. Group four. I mean, are you on the wing? Where are you? Group four? Ooh. Like I said, I've heard stories about people from group four. I wouldn't want to talk with anybody from group four. So now I'm in group four, but she's in group seven. So now I just change it. Group seven. Oh my gosh! What are you in the baggage claim? They're gonna, you know, she's a carry-on at this point. We stuff her. I have to stuff her up in those in the compartments. Group seven. Wow. So anyway, I don't know. I got on this tangent, but let me just quickly. I can't believe how much time I'm having fun though. Anyway, so. So I wanted to talk about this American Airlines or this United Airlines thing. And there was actually an incident on American Airlines, like within a week of the guy getting dragged off United. On American, there was a guy that was yelling at some mom and he took her stroller away from her. And then another guy in the row stood up and confronted the flight attendant. And there were words, and the flight attendant says to the guy, bring it on. You got a problem with me? I'm like, whoa, what? So there's a lot of lessons here, but the United Airlines thing is what started all this. And I'll tell you, this one, and I'm sure you've all seen it with the doctor getting dragged. It was an amazing sight to see. First of all, we have to know in today's society, as if you are in a public place and there is a hint of altercation or a hint of disruption, if there is anybody's voice that is even elevated above the normal kind of where public are, you know the cameras on the cell phone are on. I mean, that's the society we live in. If you don't know that, where have you been? I've got a flip phone, and I know that. I don't even do that. But I know what's going on. So you have to know on both sides of the coin, whether you are a corporate person or a customer, or you're in a fight or whatever it is, you got to know that you are being filmed. If not by regular people with their cell phones, since 9/11, you don't even know how many cameras are watching us on a daily basis. You don't even know it. So first of all, you, as just a person or a somebody who works at a company with the public, you have to know that you are the potential of you being captured on some kind of recording device is very high if there is some kind of a disturbance. But this United Airlines debacle, is all you could say, is going to be used as a case study in colleges for decades. Any kind of communications company or college or public relations class, they just United helped create the final exam for the next 20 years. Because at every level, at every step in the process of what happened here, everyone, there was like dominoes. Every person from the lowest person taking tickets at the gate, checking people in at the gate, to the CEO, they all made wrong decisions, horrible decisions. And you don't see that usually. But this went from the lowest to the highest. Everybody made horrible mistakes in either not using common sense, of adhering too strictly to policies that did not fit the situation, not thinking about how to best handle a customer, not thinking about the best way to handle a situation, and certainly from the CEO's standpoint, not knowing how to handle a major, major crisis that they are going to be digging a hole for their reputation for many years. And already they are feeling the sting of not only that video being shown all over the world and, you know, United stock taking a hit, their reputation taking a hit, their brand taking a hit. But the funny thing is, even the CEO, next year, 2018, according to his contract, he was scheduled to become chairman of the board of United as well. They've taken that off the table. So even he is going to pay for his mistakes. But the person checking the people in, you do not let people on the plane until you know where everyone is sitting. If you're going to bump me from a plane, which this, you know, as we all know, this overbooking thing is ridiculous anyway, and how they're allowed to get away with it, I'm not sure. In fact, recently, the head of United went in front of the Congress, went in front of a congressional committee to answer for not only what they did there, but then it was a field day. They're talking about, why do you guys charge for checked bags? Now all this other stuff that they've been doing since 9/11 to gain revenue after they lost a lot of revenue after 9/11 because people were afraid to fly on the planes. And they've been getting away with murder. Oh, do you want a preference seat for $35 more? You want to sit by the exit row now? Used to be the best seat in the house. Now it's $35 more if you want to sit by an exit seat. Plus, how do you charge me for my bags? You're trying to get me to travel? And then you charge me for my underwear? What am I supposed to do when I get there? What am I, Elvis? You know, Elvis Presley used to jump on a plane at a whim. And he didn't have any luggage. He's just like, hey, man, we'll buy something when we get there. Thank you very much. And that's what they did. It would be 2 in the morning, and he had the Lisa Marie 747 at the airport. And he'd go, hey, Sonny Red, let's go to Vegas. And okay. And they just jumped in the limo and went there. They didn't have any luggage, and they bought clothes. Not everybody can do that. You're charging me for my bags? Come on. And that has been their highest moneymaker. They probably said, you know, for years they were saying, gosh, wouldn't it be fantastic if we could actually charge people for their bags? And then we're at a meeting and the guy goes, yeah, but how can we can't ask people to pay for their bags? I know we can't, But God, if we ever could, if something would ever happen that we could charge them, you know the money we could make? Yeah, I know, but that'll never happen, so don't even think about it. And then 9/11 happens, and people are afraid to go on planes. And the government, there's no way the government's ever going to let one of our huge industries go out of business or go bankrupt. The airline business? We can't let that happen. It's just economically not feasible. So they said to the airlines, okay, do whatever you want to get people to fly in the planes. Just as long as they come back. And they're like, hey, we need money. We're going to charge people for bags. All right, do whatever you need to do. We're going to charge them for extra seat, you know, for a better seat. Go ahead, just don't go bankrupt. And here we are, because we want to travel. We like to travel. And now we're paying for our bags. Unbelievable. And so that guy that 15 years ago in that meeting, who was being laughed at, who said, geez, wouldn't it be great if we can charge for the bags? He's probably CEO now. Did you hear what happened to O'Donnell? No, what? That goofy idea of his. We made $1 billion last year because of that. So anyway, everyone in United made a mistake. That you do not bump somebody when they're sitting in their seat. Bump me at the gate. I'm not happy about this, but at least I have my bag with me if I have a carry-on, and I'm not in the mode now of I'm on my way. When I give that ticket in and I walk down that little tunnel and I step on that plane and I sit in my seat, I'm on my vacation. My vacation has started. You don't bump someone off. And they knew that they would have to do this. If you knew that you had too many people and you had to get your own four people on the plane, that's what added insult to injury, that these seats were for United employees needed to go somewhere. So that made it even worse. The overbooking thing was terrible. And then the idea was we have to make this available for our people ahead of customers. There was absolutely no thought of the customer at all in all these United problems. But you know how anal I am? When I'm on the plane and I'm in my seat, I sit down, I buckle my seatbelt as soon as I get on, buckle my seatbelt, and the first thing I do, if I'm going to the West Coast, I take my watch and I change the clock, my watch, to Pacific time, or if I'm going to the East Coast, I change my watch to Eastern time, because in my mind, I'm on the plane, and right now, Central Time doesn't matter. I want to know what time it is when I get there. So that's when my mindset, I'm already there. If I'm sitting down, you don't pull me off a plane. So there was, but once again, I'm sure if you talked to the employees, they would say, look, we're just following policy. And they're right to some extent. But you know what? There has to be a point when you go over the policy, when you see the policy is not right and it is infringing on a customer. Then you have to say, and I know that you don't want to lose your job. I understand that. But you know what? Those people have a union, and I guarantee you that the union would fight for them. But you know what? Just be a hero. If you get in trouble, you say, okay, well, here's the problem here, boss. We had a full flight. What am I supposed to do? Drag somebody off a plane? Hello? But no one at the lower level wanted to do that. I understand it, and at the same time, I don't understand it. There has to be some common sense involved here. But at the very least, you don't let, if you want to bump them, you just say, you know what? You make an announcement. If nobody's taking the volunteer thing, you know, the $500 and whatever, no one's taking that, here's what you say. Ladies and gentlemen, we have four seats that we need to get rid of. We cannot board this plane until we get four volunteers. So I hope four people come forward, because we can't take the plane won't take off. We cannot board until, and let's see what happens. And maybe, which is one of their fixes here, you have to up the thing to $1,000. You have to make it to a point where, you know, in the good old Godfather, Make them an offer they can't refuse. But you got to do something. And then the CEO comes out and initially is adamant about they did nothing wrong. Then they start some smear campaign about this doctor. Hey, whether he is the best doctor on earth or whether he is questionable, he was not kicked off the plane for being a potential felon or being a person of not of high character. That is not why he got knocked off the plane. So you don't bring this up. So I don't know what smart person in the United Airlines world said, well, let's smear the customer because we were following policy. I don't care about your policy. Your policy is down the drain right now. You've got a major crisis, and you've got to take responsibility for it. You've got to apologize, and most importantly, you've got to explain to me how it won't happen again. They were smearing this doctor. And I don't know whether this guy is legit or not. It doesn't matter. He wasn't kicked off for being a bad doctor or being a felon. He was knocked off because you needed four seats. Just awful, awful public relations. You know, about 30 years ago here in the Chicago area, and if you're born before the mid-80s, you won't probably remember this. You may have heard about it, though. There was a horrible, sinister crime in the Chicago area. Somebody went into pharmacies, like Walgreens or whatever, and went to the shelves for over-the-counter Tylenol for headaches, and put cyanide-filled capsules in the Tylenol. And within hours, several people took the Tylenol and died. It was horrendous. And it was so scary because it was so random. It could have happened to anybody. And this was, and it turned out that Tylenol, talking about case studies, United will be used as to how you do not handle a crisis. Tylenol is always used, and take it from me because I worked in public relations for 15 years. It is the ultimate case study of how you do handle a crisis. Tylenol was handed this crisis. It was no fault of their own. Somebody chose Tylenol because it was the most popular aspirin. And at the time, it's amazing to think about this now, but at the time, over-the-counter drugs that you bought off the shelves in a pharmacy, they had a simple screw-on cap with a piece of cotton in it. There was no sealed tab. There was no push-down, contraption to open up the top. There was just a screw-on top and a piece of cotton. So all this person had to do was go into a store with his cyanide-filled tablets that he went in, bought some legitimately, took the tablets apart, filled it with Tylenol, closed it back in, went to random stores, found a bottle, dropped it in, went to the next one. It was that simple. But what did Tylenol do? They didn't blame the pharmacies. They didn't blame the people who bought the drug. Immediately, they apologized for something that was not their fault. Secondly, to great financial loss, they pulled every bit of Tylenol product off every shelf in the country, if not the world. And not just the bottles that were tainted, every Tylenol product gone for a period of time until they could guarantee that it was safe. And what did they do? They're the ones that came up with the heightened packaging with the harder cap to unscrew and that little foil that is glued on the top. That wasn't always there. But that's what Tylenol said. We are going to make sure this doesn't happen. That's what we're going to do. And that became the industry standard then. But they did that. And as much as they had horrible, their brand was being, all over the news. But people came back and bought Tylenol, and they're still number one because the public realized that, A, it wasn't their fault, and B, they went to great financial as well as customer service to make sure it wouldn't happen again. What did United do? Just the opposite. Wasn't our fault. This guy's a felon. What are you talking about? the CEO had to make three apologies because every apology was worse than the next one. Wasn't taking full responsibility for this, wasn't contrite enough, wasn't giving me solutions. Finally, last week in a full page ad that I saw in the Tribune, they finally said, for instance, law enforcement will never be used to remove customers from now on from a flight. The overbooking, identifying need for volunteers will happen sooner at the gate. They will. I don't know how they're going to do this. The incentives can increase for volunteers up to $10,000. $10,000. So wait a minute. When they first say we need a volunteer for $300, everybody should just sit at the gate and go, okay, now wait a minute. Nobody raise your hand. We're going to let this run up to at least $7,000, and then they'll all run to the gate. How are they going to do this? I don't know, but it sounds appealing. They will have a dedicated team to find other travel options. They will have some reimbursements. And here's the most important. They will develop new tools and training for employees to solve issues for our customers in the moment. Yeah, that's what should have happened at the gate. But this came 2.5 weeks later. Too late. Now, given that United is one of the biggest airlines in the world, it flies everywhere, people need to travel, I don't know how much it's going to hurt them in terms of actually buying tickets if people are going to just boycott United, but in terms of their reputation, they're in trouble. And you have to wonder, you know, are companies, have they forgotten about customer service? Because I'll tell you, I go to department stores or grocery stores and wow. I mean, you got cash people, you know, people at the cash register giving you attitude. It's like, do you realize I'm paying your salary? And believe me, I speak from experience. When I was in high school, I was a bagger at Jewel, and I also was a cashier. And I know that I had to be nice to people, even though they were sometimes rude and angry and questioning me, or you didn't give me the right change and all that stuff. I couldn't give them attitude. Customer's always right. I don't know about today, though. We got both sides. We've got customers believing that they can do whatever they want, and now you've got employees giving it back to the customers. I don't know, folks. We got to take a good look at our work ethic here. I mean, I don't know if people just don't want to do their jobs. Everybody, I don't know. Is everybody just waiting for their reality show? Yeah, you know, I work at a department store. I'm really a blogger. I'm very interesting. I'm trying to get on a reality show. I'm a really good chef. I want to be on a cooking show, but I am working, you know, at Walmart right now. Well, yeah, okay. Well, that's what you do then. You're not a reality star. You got to start buckling down here, folks. But anyway, United Airlines. I don't know how friendly the skies are, but we will find out in the coming months. And we're back here at Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic with the very ever-popular segment, Pop Culture Club. My good friend Emily Armanetti. How are you doing, Emily?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
That's Emily's new welcoming. That's your new theme. You know what? I used to play this little pop culture or culture club for the Pop Culture Club segment, but I don't know. I think from right now it just might be, and now with the Pop Culture Club, here's Emily Armanetti. And if you didn't hear, last week before Emily came on, I hit the right buttons. She wasn't used to coming on when I introduced her, and so she was clearing up all the phlegm in her throat. And so I said, hey, Emily, and she's like, hi, Jim. So it's,
no.
Yeah, so it's good to hear. It, wow, wow. Listen, listen now.
No phlegm.
Well, listen now. You must have been clearing your voice for the last hour. Just getting ready.
Do you know what's so funny? I yesterday all day I felt like I was fighting off a cold. I was like, oh no.
I love when I get in people's heads. That's what I love. That's you just made my day. But or their throats, I guess. But anyway, so I thought that this was it. Now, you know, here's real quick. I wanted to, you know, Emily and I first met when we worked together in public relations. Do you have any quick, I don't want to get too much into it because I just ranted and raved, but, you know, from a United Airlines PR standpoint, just how, really, how bad did they handle this? Because Emily is a public relations executive as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think you've pretty much captured it. This is going to be taught as a case study for what not to do in a crisis situation. But I will say, like, what they've done in the last week, you know, they settled with their customer.
Oh, you know what? That's such a great.
Or should I say victim?
Their victim, yeah. Very good. Yeah. I'd say that's such a great point, too.
Yeah.
Oh, how?
So they settled with the customer.
And they settled in 2 seconds. What do you think?
But see, that's all important to now correcting. They did such a terrible job of handling it when it happened. So now it's like, you know, their best course of action was to settle as quickly as possible, you know, get this guy's attorney, instead of this guy's attorney out, like, holding press conferences, get this guy's attorney to be talking to the media and telling them, you know what, we're all happy. Just now everybody's happy. And then, you know, they've rolled out this kind of, like, 10-point policy change. And, you know, that was the right thing to do as well. But it just, they should have done it, you know, right when this happened.
So,
or even just at least acknowledged or said, like, we are so sorry this happened. We are investigating this. This is a top priority for us, and we will be looking at, you know, whether we need to make changes to our policies. Like, that actually could have helped it blow over right away. But,
yeah.
You know, of course, today everything is, you know, things are also amplified by the fact that, you know, there are video cameras everywhere you go. And
yeah.
So when things like this get caught on tape, you know, not only did they not handle it well, but, you know, there's a video. We're not just talking about, like, people describing it. So you can actually just go online and watch it.
Oh,
know?
Exactly. Yeah.
So that makes.
But here's the thing. I mean, you bring up such a great point. This has never been, you know, this is pure conjecture, but I would have to. This guy. Yes, I mean, I know he got his, you know, his teeth broken and whatever happened to him, but at the end of the day, he basically won the lottery. I mean, what do you think he
did? And he didn't, though. He didn't. Because I'll tell you what. As soon as this happened, right? First of all, there's this extremely humiliating video of him being dragged off an airplane. But then also, you know. Now, then the media started to, not that maybe it wasn't even the media, I'm sure it was somebody somewhere who was working, maybe not at United, but maybe for United in some capacity. Oh, suddenly, like, there's like dirt on this guy.
Oh, yeah, that was ridiculous.
You know,
that smear campaign.
The legal troubles that he had.
Yeah, that was ridiculous.
Yeah. Right.
But you know what?
So,
hey.
So the guy has been literally and figuratively dragged through the mud, you know, and so that all, I mean, I don't know I suppose we'll never know how much money he got in compensation for this in the settlement, but you have to think to yourself, like, man, is it really worth all that? I mean, who really wants to get,
well, yeah, but come on, think about it. All he did was buy a seat on an airplane, right?
Right.
And a month later, he got at least $5 million. I think he got at least $5 million because, to your point about you want to clean this up and get this out of the headlines as quick as possible. If there's a potential, yeah. Not only are there potential every time, to your point, every time, his lawyer calls a press conference when the news covers it, they will show the videotape. Then when the trial comes, the videotape comes back again. You want that videotape to disappear as fast as possible. And so I would have to think that the cost of that videotape disappearing has to be at least $5 million, if not more. I'll be honest with you. I don't know. I have no idea.
You're probably right.
But I would think
it's worth it to them to make it go away. It is.
Yeah, I mean, and $5 million is a lot of money to the average person. But it might not be that much to a company as big as United Airlines that is taking a major, that's losing hundreds of millions of dollars every day with their stock price going down. So if you have to give this guy $5 or $10 million to make this go away and hopefully stabilize your stock price, it's worth it. But my gosh, I understand the personal humiliation that you're saying that this guy might be going through, but having $5 or $10 million in the bank is a great way to cure humiliation. I've done a lot of things. I've done a lot of humiliating things for a lot less than $5 million.
Well, let's see. Let's see what you can do next. I don't know. Are you flying anywhere anytime soon?
Well, you know, I did actually fly this past weekend. And it's impossible for you not to make a drag me off the plane joke. It's impossible.
Well, the funny thing is, it's probably impossible to get kicked off a plane right now.
That's true. I mean, yeah, you
can. At least right now.
That's true.
You know, a month from now, you might be able, everything might be back.
You're exactly right. It's like you can act real obnoxious, and you would be dying to be dragged off because that's your $5 million ticket now. That's your golden ticket, and they won't even touch you.
Right.
Oh man, I never thought about that.
This is your new like retirement plan.
Yeah, I mean, I was telling earlier, I was on a plane this weekend we went to the Boston area, and so the Cubs owner Tom Ricketts and the president Theo Epstein were on my plane. And so I was texting with my flip phone.
Oh, really? You can text on your flip phone?
From my flip phone on the plane, I was texting to my godson, and he's a big Cub fan, and I said, hey, Ricketts and Theo on my plane. And he's like, cool. And I go, oops, they just got dragged off. You know, I mean, it's impossible not to make a dragged off the plane joke. I mean, like, you know, usually they always say that after something happens, then it's the safest thing. And so right now, you could, if you want to be really obnoxious as a member on a flight, now's your time.
Now's the time to do it.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
That's right.
That's a real good point. But I just find it amazing how United is such a big company, and I'm, you know, both their internal PR people, and I'm sure that they've got, crisis management, or they've got an outside PR firm. And you and I have both worked both for internal companies where we've been, worked for companies in their PR, departments, and then worked at an agency. That's where you and I met. And so we both worked in crisis with companies, not as big as something like this, at least I haven't, but kind of close. I mean, there's something that was certainly important to the company. And when you see a company like United handle this so poorly, I'm baffled at where they were getting this horrible, horrible advice. I mean, it took them.
Yeah,
three apologies.
Crisis is. Yeah, I mean, as you know, though, it definitely takes a special skill set, you know, to really effectively handle and manage a crisis like that. And so you need to have the right people in place. But the thing about crisis communications is you can't wait until something happens before you have a plan in place. Like, you may not know exactly what the nature of that crisis is going to be, but you need to have that team in place, you know, that you pick up the bat phone and you call them no matter what time of day something happens. And I'm guessing in this case, it is probably a simple case that they just didn't have the right, you know, people ready to mobilize to respond to something like this. And they kind of tried to just do it, you know, fly. That just does not work.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And the other side of the coin is, and anybody who works in public relations will know this, that unfortunately, and I'm not, and so, you know, I shouldn't even say that in a blanket way, that they got bad advice, because for all we know, and having been in that situation myself, and I'm sure you have in your career as well, unfortunately, you as the expert in the room, a lot of times the executives, you will explain the way to handle this. You explain why. You explain what your plan will do, the desired effects, and they think that they know everything. And they will not take your advice. So, you know, be honest with you, I may even be a little hard on United PR because I don't know how much of this, for all we know, the United PR people and their outside firm, if they have one, were saying to him, here's what you have to do and here's what you have to say. And he may have said, oh, I'm not saying that.
Right.
So you never know. And that happens so many times. And then what's so frustrating from a public relations person's standpoint is that you lay out the plan, as you correctly said, you lay out the plan and you try to say, if we do this, then A, B, and C will most likely happen. And that will put us in a good spot moving forward. They reject that plan and they decide to do it their own way. The worst happens because they did not follow your advice, but then you can't come back to them when they've made the situation worse and say, I told you so, because all they say is clean it up.
Here's what you do now.
Yeah, now it's your job to clean up my mess again. And you're sitting there to yourself saying, geez, if you listened to me, we wouldn't be in this spot. They don't want to hear that. They want to hear, what are you going to do to clean up my mess? Because in their minds, they didn't make a mistake anyway. So it's really a bad situation. But like I said, when you see so many people down the line making poor choices, this one really goes down in the history books because everybody made a bad decision. You know, the people at the ticket counter made the bad decision. The law enforcement people that were brought onto the plane to drag the guy off and hit him made bad decisions. And then the backside of it with the corporate side of not being contrite enough, not coming forth immediately with solutions. You can't do, what happened has happened. You made it exactly correct. But as you said, the important thing is, tell me what you're going to do to make it good now and moving forward. And they didn't do that either until 2 weeks later. It's too late in terms of PR.
It's just a simple tactical matter of changing the news cycle. You know, it's like, okay, you know, nobody is going to stop talking about the video until you come out with something substantial. So, like, you know, the settlement, again, the policy change, but that was weeks after the fact.
Yeah.
Had they come out immediately talking about stuff like that, you've now moved the news cycle from, look at what they did to this guy, to, okay, this is what United is saying now. By taking the whole victim-blaming approach, that then got everything just still
caught in the cycle. That was awful.
Now they're doubling down on this kind of behavior, it's definitely one for the textbook.
I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's great if you're in the PR world, you get to sit around and say, well, here's what I would have done. But at this point, too, with so much media and so many, consultants out there, that you would think, the consultants would know the right thing to do, and they may have. And you really have to say to the CEO and the executives is that, you brought us in because we're professionals. I'm not telling you about how to get planes out of gates on time. So you can't tell me how to manage a crisis, at least a PR crisis. You know, if it's a financial crisis, that's your job. But so often, people think they know how to handle PR. And oh my gosh, to your point about having a plan in place, that's so true. And it happened to me about 10 years ago. I was working for the Alzheimer's Association. And so the Alzheimer's Association had a very close relationship with the Reagan family after Ronald Reagan announced that he had Alzheimer's. And so it was a foregone conclusion that Reagan was going to die of Alzheimer's. And so as time went on, Reagan did have a long life and did live with Alzheimer's for many years. However, each year as time went on, it was very obvious that, okay, the end is getting close. And so the Alzheimer's Association, and when I was there, I did contribute to it to some extent. We had a plan, just like you said. When Reagan dies, here's the plan.
Mm-hmm.
Here are the spokespeople that we've already, you know, vetted and are will be on call to talk about certain aspects of the disease, to be able to talk about the Alzheimer's Association, to tell how people can, you know, donate, to talk about how Ronald Reagan was important to Alzheimer's, to talk about the medical advances, to talk about what, you know, all the main messages and topics that we wanted and the right people, those, that plan was written up. Those people were aware they were a part of it, and whether it happened tomorrow or 5 years ago, 5 years from now, they knew it was going to they knew that they were going to be on call. And sure enough, I was at my godson's high school graduation, and I was, you know,
and you got the call.
And here's the best part: I'm talking to my godson's grandfather earlier at the party. And he says, "Oh, where are you what are you doing now?" I said, "Oh, I'm at the Alzheimer's Association." And I said, "In fact, you know, we got, oh, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, blah, blah, blah." And I said, "In fact, you know, we've got a, you know, we deal with the Reagan family and we've got this plan, blah, blah, blah," right? 45, I'm not, this was unbelievable. 45, you know, I'm at a party. I'm not checking my phone and everything. 45 minutes later, after I talked to him about the plan and that we had this plan, I went around and mingled with other people, and I circled back around, and I happened to see him. So the grandfather says to me, "So, so what are you doing now? What do you have to do now?" I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, Reagan died." And so I'm like, because the guy's kind of a joker. I said, "Yeah." I said, "Yeah, well, that's." He goes, "No." He says, "About 10 minutes ago, someone just heard on the radio that Ronald Reagan died." I'm like, "Are you BSing me?" He goes, "No." He goes, "So I take my," at that time I had a flip phone, but they were cool. You know.
Right.
There were no iPhones
that was back when they were making flip phones.
Yeah, they were actually cutting edge at that time. So I flipped my phone I hit my email or my voicemail, and sure enough, they're like, "Jim, get downtown because it was just get downtown to deal with this. Help us, you know."
That's
and
right.
I was out in Crystal Lake. I had to drive an hour, and I came down, and we were there for, you know, almost, you know, 17 hours handling all
right.
that.
But you got to hunker down in the war room.
Yeah, but exactly what you said. The fact was, it was as chaotic and crazy as it was, it wasn't in that it was time-consuming and it was hectic in terms of the logistics, but the plan was in place. The people and spokespeople were ready. And it wasn't chaos. It was, you know, it was a lot of adrenaline. There was a lot of activity going on, but it wasn't chaos because the plan was there. It was sitting, it was waiting, and all it was doing was waiting to be implemented. And so that's exactly right. What you said. You know, this, you know, especially with airlines knowing that they overbook, this was not impossible to predict that this might happen.
No, I mean, I actually didn't realize how, I mean, I guess I do realize that every flight you get on these days is overbooked, but I don't think I ever did realize before this that they can and they will have you get out of your seat when you're already on your seat in the plane, and they will, you know, bump you for, you know, for crew members or, you know, people who need transport. Like I didn't even know that was even a possibility. Now, one of the good things to come out of this is that it's not just United, but other airlines have now come out and said that they are doing away with this overbooking policy.
Well, I think. Well, yeah. I mean,
which is a good thing.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's a crazy. It's a crazy policy to begin with. I mean, I have a lot of sympathy. As much as I said that, you know, somebody at the gate should have used a little common sense and realize the situation you had here, and maybe you break the rules or bend the rules in order for chaos not to happen. But at the other side, the other side of the coin is, I really have a lot of empathy for people at the ticket gate because, for instance, you know that when those people came on to their shift at that gate for that flight, they knew that flight was overbooked. They knew they were going to have to find volunteers, and they knew that they had four people, you know, employees, they had to get on their plane. They knew coming in, they had to have made up, oh my gosh, oh, this is going to be a pain in the butt, because this was kind of, you know, a perfect storm. And they already and they probably face that every day, you know, out of an 8-hour shift, you know, five times there's a flight just like that, and they've got to deal with that. And so they know how bad the overbooking policy is because they have to deal with it on a daily basis, an hourly basis.
And it also can't be the first time somebody got upset because they were being bumped from a flight.
Well, my point is,
definitely not the first time someone's been escorted off a flight. Not, I mean, for this particular reason, maybe, or that it escalated to this point. But you know, it's true. Like, they should have a playbook that has a bunch of scenarios that they're actually, like you said, probably happen all the time. Like, sure, people don't get, you know, beat up getting taken off flights all the time. But, like, again, a playbook in place for, like, okay, so what's our response when this happens and when this happens and it ends up in the news, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, unbelievable. Like I said, when I saw that happening and then I saw this unfolding, I was just sitting there going, wow. And then as it unfolded over the first couple of days, I said, oh, my gosh, these guys are doing everything wrong.
I mean,
they did everything wrong. And as I said, I wonder, you know, is it people not knowing what to do in their jobs? Is it people too afraid to keep their jobs that they don't inject some common sense? Is it companies or corporations not really caring about the customer as much as they should anymore? I don't know what it is, but, you know, we talk about our economy. And ways to stimulate our economy on both sides of the coin. I don't know how much people are invested in jobs that they really don't care or like as much as they should. And you know what? When I worked in high school, I worked at a grocery store. It wasn't what I wanted to do for a living for the rest of my life. But while I was there for those 4 hours a shift, that was my job. I wasn't thinking about anything else except I'm here. I'm getting paid. That's what's on my mind. Is my job here. Then when I leave, I can go and do whatever I want. But while I'm there, and I don't know how many times people are doing that. I mean, my gosh, you know, on American Airlines, did you see that video of the attendant who was telling the passenger to bring it on?
Yeah, this was the stroller incident.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like, bring it on. What?
Right.
What are you talking about? I mean, you know, there is something to be said for the customer's always right, even when the customer's wrong. They're still right.
Right. Well, you know, it gets complicated, I think, with airlines. And I think this is part of what made this such a big mess for United, because in a post 9/11 world, you know, we do have to acknowledge that a flight crew has a job to do. And that job is not just to, you know, show us to our seats. And, you know, and give us handout pretzels and, you know,
exactly.
Soda and drinks,
yeah.
Right? And so I think it is, they do need to thread the needle a little bit between, you know, really needing that when they really need to handle a situation that could potentially threaten other passengers' security or safety on the plane. And when they need to actually handle situations delicately. And I think that they're struggling right now to figure out how to thread that needle. And I do think it's because we live in a slightly more complicated world these days, where they do have to, you know, manage sometimes, you know, real safety issues and real security issues. But in this case, I mean, this just wasn't one of those scenarios. And they sort of, they took a real, like, you know, they handled it. They went way over the top with the way that they handled it and, you know, calling security to have him removed. And so I think that that's part of what made this a lot more complicated and made it escalate the way that it did.
You know what, Emily? When I hear you talk like that with so much authority and knowledge, now I know why I hired you.
But look, maybe you and I are going to get job offers from United.
We should. Yeah, I mean, Emily and I worked together for what? Well,
one
we worked.
Day you got baskets of Glade showing up on your doorstep. The next day, you can have a job offer.
Well, I tell you, I wanted to be on radio from when I was a little kid, when I was 12 years old. So this was always my goal. But I really enjoyed my time in public relations, and I did enjoy. The crises as well as, you know, doing the stuff that just helped promote things And I did enjoy the idea of, okay, here's the problem and how do we solve it? And I always enjoy collaborating with people and getting working as a team. And so, and as I said, even though, officially, I hired Emily and I, she worked for me as part of my team, but I always viewed you as a peer and certainly view you as a friend now, obviously. But, just to hear you, I just listening, I'm like, boy, you know what? You really know your stuff there, pal.
I sort of sound like I know what I'm talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah, I'm glad I hired.
Okay, so
now I know why I hired
when United
you.
United calls you, and you get the call from United. Just right. remember, we're a package deal.
Oh, okay? No problem. I would love to work again with you. I've had a ball for the last several months, but yeah, we had some good times, and we did some cool things in the PR world together. And I'm glad we've had a chance to do this together. And on that note,
for sure.
Even though I'm a segment tease. I mention segments at the beginning of the show, and I get people all psyched up and all hot and heavy, and then I don't deliver.
Yeah, you don't.
Because at the beginning of the show, I teased that we were going to talk about our top concerts that we saw, but we've run out of time here, so we're going to do that next week or the week or after that. So just make your cool list of your favorite concerts, because that's an evergreen topic. But real quick, how was Tom Petty the other night?
My list is ready. Tom Petty last night was great.
Yeah.
I saw him last night here in Austin. They're on their 40th anniversary tour, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Yeah, did he play obscure hits as well as the hits, or what did he do?
They played everything. I mean, I don't even know. Do they have any obscure hits? I feel like most of their catalog is so well known.
Yeah.
But they played everything, and it was a really long show. It was a great show. I think Tom Petty, I saw him like 3 or 4 years ago in New York, and I was amazed at how great he sounds. And honestly, like they were great. It was a great show. And Gary Clark Jr., who I don't know if you know him, he's kind of
definitely. Yeah. No, he's the big blues local. Guitarist. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I figured you would probably know him, but he's local. He lives here in Austin and he opened for them. And so it was all around a really great show. Definitely worth seeing if,
he's playing it.
They've come through Chicago. Have they come through Chicago?
No, not yet.
They're
playing at Wrigley Field. Which is even
Wrigley Field. That's right. Somebody told me that.
Yeah, so even cooler. So I'm going to have to try to see that. I haven't seen him in a while. I've seen him several times over the years. In fact, one of the coolest concerts I saw of Tom Petty, you weren't even born yet, probably, was in like 1980. Like 1980?
Oh.
Were you born? You were born,
yeah,
right?
Sadly, I was alive then.
Yeah.
I was a youngin', though.
But he had just,
I think I was a youngin'.
He had just hit, he was flying high with Dan the Torpedoes, with Don't Do Me Like That, and... and Here Comes My Girl and Refugee, that album is great. That's a seminal
album.
Yeah. But the coolest thing was they did the loop was the radio, the radio station, the rock station, which played the heck out of that. They did a free concert. The whole, you called in and you got ticket. The whole arena, it was at the Horizon, now the Allstate Arena, was all free.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to call in and everybody got free tickets. And I got into that concert. And that was it was just a great show because everybody was psyched up to be going to the concert for free to begin with. And he was at the height of his powers with the Damn the Torpedoes album. So it was a very, very cool show. Always have liked Tom Petty and still love the Traveling Wilburys and love the work he did with them. So. And one of my favorite songs is "Stop Drag." Did they do "Stop Dragging My Heart Around"?
No, but when Stevie Nicks was here, like not that long ago, it was only like a month or so ago, she brought Chrissy Hynde out. The Pretenders opened up for her. And
nice,
she brought Chrissy Hynde out, and they duetted.
Oh,
yeah,
nice!
It was great.
Nice.
I was wondering if he was going to play it.
Yeah,
but
that's one of my favorites.
You really kind of have to have someone to duet.
Yeah, you definitely.
He did. He brought Gary Clark Jr. out for a couple of songs, but more to play guitar, not so much to accompany him. Vocally.
Well, once again, Emily, it's always great to talk to you. It's great to hear not only your throat clearing, but it's also here to.
You like to hear how clear my voice.
Yeah, you
like,
did, and
so clear today.
Your voice was clear, and your advice was clear, as well, and your expertise.
Right. I know. I'm. Yeah.
I'm very...
Batting 1,000. Is that what you say? Is that the right term?
Batting 1,000. Yeah.
Is it batting 1,000?
You hit a home run. There you go.
Home run today.
Home run. Well, great job, Emily. Always fun to talk to you. We will talk again to you soon. And stay cool over there in the cool place of Austin.
I will. Thanks, Jim.
All right. Take care. And that is episode 51 in the can of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, a new episode is posted, or on my landing page, all my previous 50 and counting podcasts for you to enjoy. I'm Jim Toronto. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. This is the only podcast that goes from the end of the web to your screen.